Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon, and welcome to a spectacular Saturday. Just absolutely gorgeous here in the Northeast today. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Delighted to be back with you. Off last week because of Memorial Day weekend and the Red Sox playing an early afternoon game. But fear not, we're back in our regular 12 noon until 1 p.m. time slot, and we're delighted to be with you. We would love to help you with any legal questions, legal issues, legal matters that concern you. And we do that by taking your phone calls at 860-522-WTIC. That's 522-9842. And we're only here until 1 o'clock. So if you're thinking about giving us a call, maybe sitting on the fence, not really sure, better to call a little bit earlier than later, because that allows us to give you a little more time and make sure that we can give you the attention that you deserve and that we'd like to give you. So let me tell you what we have lined up for today. We're going to take a review of a bunch of legal topics that are in the news, and some of them you may have heard a little bit about. Others, I think you probably have not. And we'll talk about why each one of these has some meaning for us and why it is that we're selecting them. So first up, COVID-19. Well, everybody is sick of hearing about it, and we were all affected by it one way or another. However, the legal system is still dealing with all kinds of fallout from COVID-19 in general, and more particularly from the governor's executive orders, which were implemented to try and deal with it during its worst. So we're going to talk a little bit about how this has worked its way into the court system. More specifically, it has to do with businesses that were unable to operate in their normal fashion, sometimes barely able to operate at all, about how they're raising the executive orders as a defense to lawsuits against them collecting unpaid rent and, in certain cases, trying to evict them. The Supreme Court has finally spoken on that issue, so we'll get some clarity in it in the other decisions, but it's very interesting how they chose to resolve that, and we'll be talking about that in addition to taking your calls. Following that, a phrase that you may or may not have heard, the phrase is informed consent. Well, what does that mean and why should you care? We're going to tell you all about what it means. And when you hear about what happened to this mother whose young child was subjected to dental procedures that had not been consented to, you'll see why it is that knowing about it is not only going to be helpful to you, but is important for you to know about. Okay. If we have a chance, we're going to get into a topic that we haven't talked about before, and this is driven by a recent case from the Superior Court. A lot of times, people that have been involved in the legal system, especially in the housing court, especially in the family court with divorces, dissolutions of marriage, custody fights, things like that, get very, very angry about the judges or very, very angry at the judges. Sometimes you can probably almost hear people thinking in the court, or, oh, I wish I could sue that so-and-so. Well, here's somebody who tried it. And if you've ever thought about it, you should listen up, because this will tell you what happens and certain obstacles that are going to come up that you should know about if you're even considering doing this. Okay. Finally, there's a brief ruling from the United States Supreme Court that affects social media companies, Twitter and companies like that, who for various reasons choose to edit various sites or shut down various sites. They're private companies. They do this. The state of Texas passed a law which basically was intended to prohibit these companies from doing that type of thing. It ended up before the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll tell you briefly what the U.S. Supreme Court did about that, what they did with it, and where that leaves us. So that's the lineup for today. And what we'll start off with today is basically the business about COVID in the courts. Now, as I started to explain a little bit earlier, this is something that has come up a lot in a commercial context. Somebody operates a store, and restaurants in particular were very hard hit. The executive orders that were issued often prohibited them from having people into their dining rooms. In some cases, they felt they couldn't work at all. The orders, even at their most stringent, allowed carry-out food or curbside delivery. Well, this is the story of a restaurant in South Norwalk, high-end restaurant, white glove service and everything else. And they believed that they simply could not operate at all under the restrictions which the executive orders imposed upon them. Their landlord sued them to recover unpaid rent. And even though it was only a few months, it amounted to a couple of $100,000. So the restaurant raised a bunch of defenses at the trial level, and we'll touch on some of those now so that you have an idea of what they did. And they said, because of these different defenses that we're raising, we should be excused from having to pay the landlord the rent that we agreed to in our lease. So at the trial level, they said, first of all, the first defense was impossibility of performance. And the second defense was a French phrase called force majeure. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And the third one was called frustration of purpose. So the theme in all of these defenses raised by the defendant restaurant was that because the executive orders issued by the governor in response to the COVID pandemic curtailed their operations to such a tremendously large extent, it was impossible for them to perform under the lease. The force majeure concept we'll discuss, although it turns out they didn't have a force majeure clause in their lease after all. And then the doctrine is frustration of purpose. So the trial court tried this case, heard all of these arguments, and then basically issued a judgment in favor of the landlord. And the general reasoning was, well, you didn't really get put out of business by these orders because they still permitted you to provide carryout food. They still permitted you to provide curbside pickup. And when the weather got better and warmer, they allowed outside dining. And just like a number of other restaurants, you chose to take advantage of that and put out lots and lots of tables. So the trial court says, no, you owe $200,000 in change to the landlord because that's what your lease says. So this ended up going all the way to the Connecticut Supreme Court. Now, if one restaurant was relying upon these defenses as an excuse for not paying its rent, you can imagine that there were any number of similar facilities that were doing that. And while it wasn't just restaurants, those were the ones that were affected probably the most dramatically by the executive orders and the ones that relied probably to a much greater extent than other businesses on that foot traffic. Even brick and mortar retail stores were able to do some online sales business. But if you've got a high-end restaurant, which was basically marketing not only its good food, but the general ambiance and the general experience, it's awfully difficult to get by. So the Supreme Court basically upheld the trial court. And the Supreme Court basically said that the executive orders did not cease or excuse the restaurant's obligatory payments. They said that even under the most restrictive executive orders, using the premises for restaurant purposes was not rendered factually impossible because they could still, guess what, provide curbside or takeout service. Now, the business about curbside and takeout service, it was not prohibited in the lease between the landlord and the restaurant, and the Supreme Court grasped at that and said, no, since it wasn't prohibited, you could still have done it. The law says that you aren't guaranteed a profitable business, but you are guaranteed the right to try to at least carry out a business. Now, the business about force majeure, I mentioned that French phrase, and we'll talk about that for just a second here. That's a concept in the law that we almost never saw until COVID-19. It's been around forever. It's deeply embedded in the common law. And what it says is that something happened that was unanticipated by either party, which renders the obligations under the lease impossible to perform. Typically, this is weather-related events, catastrophic storms. Sometimes labor shortages have been used as a basis for that also. But in this case, the court pointed out, well, we don't have to talk about force majeure because your lease didn't have any force majeure provisions in it, and you can't just go ahead and raise them otherwise. The last thing, this doctrine of frustrated purpose, basically the court talked about a lot of sister states that looked at these cases. They said that this one was different because guess what? The situation did not prevent takeout or subsequent outdoor dining, and therefore, they said, put differently, the lease terms did not by themselves render the lease agreement valueless in light of the executive orders. So that's the story, and the reason I think that's helpful to know is because all of us, one way or another, experienced massive changes in our lives as a result, not only of COVID-19, but of the executive orders that were implemented. And a lot of these have been playing out in the court system, and now we've got some closure and some final authority. We're going to be back with more, and we'd be delighted to hear your phone calls and your questions, legal in nature, at 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. Pardon me. You're listening to WTIC News Talk 1080, WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. Me, I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and we'll be back right after this. Everybody, welcome back to Law Talk on a sunny Saturday afternoon. I'm Attorney John Matulis. Tom is at the controls, and we'd be delighted to hear your legal question, your legal comment at 860-522-9842-522-WTIC. I mentioned earlier that we're going to talk about this concept called informed consent, and you might wonder, well, what does that mean, and why would I even care? Well, we're going to try to explain both of those for you, okay? Informed consent is a concept that basically grows out of medical care and more particularly about medical malpractice litigation. It is a theory in medical malpractice litigation, but it is the least favored theory. It's sort of a theory of last resort. And we're going to talk about a case involving a pediatric dentist, his mom, the State of Connecticut Department of Public Health, the board, the dentistry board, and how all of this shook out. Okay, so basically, this is what happened. Dr. Leiby is a very well qualified pediatric dentist, He's a member of the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, has been since 1990. That's 30 years or so. He specializes in the care for children under general anesthesia at the Connecticut Children's Medical Center. So we're talking about somebody that certainly seems to occupy a position of considerable prominence. And the story here is that he was treating a three-year-old patient, and he found that he needed to place a steel crown in the child's mouth. The mother was told about this, okay? And the mother apparently said, well, I want to hear after you've done the x-rays about what else is going on. Well, Dr. Adlibi did the stainless steel crown, but he didn't stop there. He did seven more stainless steel crown placements. And he did that without mom's knowledge, let alone mom's consent. She had signed several forms previously authorizing, quote, treatment of diseased or injured teeth with dental restoration, parentheses, filling or caps, close parentheses, close quote. So it looks like Dr. Adlibi felt that he was probably covered on that. The mother felt differently. She said, I expressly told him that when he did the x-rays, I wanted to hear from him further before he proceeded. So what mom did was to file a complaint with the Department of Public Health. Now, some may not be aware of it, but the Department of Public Health has an office called PLIS, which is Practitioner Licensing and Investigating Service. There's another one called FLIS, which is Facilities Licensing and Investigation Service. So one of the points for you today is if you have a complaint against a licensed healthcare provider, you can present it to the Department of Public Health. And if they believe that it appears to have some merit, they will investigate it. And if necessary, they will prosecute a formal complaint or a formal set of charges. So in this case, the Department of Public Health investigated and they presented charges, and those charges went to the Connecticut State Dental Commission. And Dr. Adlibi was brought up on these charges. They had hearings. There was expert witness testimony on both sides. The Dental Commission had an expert pediatric dentistry practitioner who basically said, against that factual backdrop, he had an absolute obligation to get the informed consent of the mother. He failed to do so. Dr. Adlibi came up with an expert, similarly qualified, who said that he had not violated the informed consent, but then when he was told about the fact that the mother had claimed that she expressly stated this, which I guess was disputed in the trial, he said, well, if that was the case, then he would have violated the standard. So the State Dental Commission here, the name is the State Connecticut State Dental Commission, they fined him $10,000, and they put him on probation, and they put a reprimand on his license. Now, there's no indication that the work that he did was defective or deficient. This seems to revolve exclusively around this issue of informed consent. Dr. Adlibi appealed the decision to the Superior Court. They found a couple of shortcomings, sent it back to the State Dental Commission. The State Dental Commission looked at it further, issued some backup for its decision back to the Superior Court, and they upheld the Dental Commission, and then it went to the Appellate Court. So what is this business about informed consent? And more importantly, for our listeners, why do you need to know about it? Let's do the second question first. The reason we all need to know about it is because if we are considering an elective medical or dental procedure, the practitioner is obligated to notify us of all known risks associated with that procedure. And the reason for that, even if some of those are very remote, the reason for that is because you have the right to make an informed decision about whether to proceed with the suggested procedure or not. And if you happen to hear about known dangers or known risks, and you can take those into account in making your decision, then you've made an informed decision. But if the doctor or the practitioner, in this case the dentist, fails to advise you of certain risks, then you haven't had the fullest opportunity to make an informed decision. So why is this one of the least favored theories in medical malpractice? The reason is that in order to win on an informed consent theory, you have to prove not only that the practitioner failed to notify you of certain known risks that the standard of care required him or her to notify you about, but also that you have to prove that had you been notified of those risks, you wouldn't have proceeded not to go through with that recommended treatment. And that's the thing that seems to be the biggest problem. Medical malpractice patients basically are in need of some sort of relief, and that's why they're looking for a medical or a dental procedure. So if you list all of the procedures, including the known procedures, are they going to simply say, well, even though I need this relief, this jaw is killing me, I'm not going to do it because of the risk? Most of them are going to do it anyway. So that has developed into one of the reasons why lack of informed consent is a difficult case. And for a minute here, I'm just going to talk about a brief case I had in private practice. We had a dental malpractice claim against an oral maxillofacial surgeon. He took our patient and put her through a procedure that damaged badly what's called her trigeminal nerve, and she had a permanent facial droop as a result. But we couldn't find he had done anything wrong, except he didn't tell her about the risk. So during his deposition, he readily admitted that. And then he volunteered. He said, look, if I had to tell every patient that I operate on about every risk, no matter how remote they are, A, it would take me 3 hours, and B, half of them would not do it anyway. So that was what he said. Our expert said, well, it's a little different. Here's this little pamphlet from our academy, the American Academy of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons, tells you for every procedure what you got to tell them. Here's the procedure he did. Look at item number 3, risk of permanent facial droop due to trigeminal nerve damage. So anyway, after the deposition of our expert in New York, the defense lawyer and I rode back on the train to Hartford together, and we had the case settled by the time we got back to Hartford. I'm attorney John Matulis, and Law Talk continues after the news, sports, and weather.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours.
and great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Okay, welcome back to Law Talk right here, WTIC. I'm attorney John Matulis. Delighted to be with you. In fact, just wanted to let you know that June of 2022, the month that we are in now, and the first show of the month that we're doing, marks the 20th anniversary of Law Talk right here on WTIC News Talk 1080. Originally conceived with Ray Dunaway and Steve Salhaney, and it was given a try, and it's been on the air ever since. So for those of you that have been listening loyally, thank you so much for that. Unless and until told otherwise, we expect to keep doing exactly what we've been doing. One of the things we've been doing is reminding you, usually during this portion of the program, that if you don't have a lawyer and you're looking for some inexpensive and quality legal advice, we recommend that you consider contacting the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Now, this is a group of lawyers that have all been vetted. They are insured. They are experienced. They are free of disciplinary problems, and they practice well in the areas to which you might be referred. What happens is you call the phone number that I'm going to give you shortly, and they'll ask you a few questions to determine the nature of your legal issue, your legal inquiry. You then get referred to an attorney who fits into the right category of practice and, as I mentioned, is experienced and is insured. So what do you get and what does it cost? What you get is a half-hour consult with that attorney. It can be in the attorney's office. It can be over the telephone. You can do a Zoom, whatever the two of you decide you want to do. And at the end of that half hour, there is no further obligation whatsoever. There's no hard sell for further services. However, if further services are requested or desired, you and the attorney are free to discuss that. And if you choose to go forward together, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine also. So that's what you get. Now, what does it cost? Well, here's the cost. It's a one-time only fee of $35 that goes to pay a part of the costs for running this not-for-profit program. It goes to pay for rent, for telephones, for staff, and the other miscellaneous expenses in the business. But there's a couple of exceptions, okay? Exception number one, if you call about your personal injury claim, they will waive the $35 fee. That means if you called because you've been hurt in an accident, no $35 fee. Another exception, if you have a workers' compensation claim, same situation, no fee for the half-hour consult with an attorney who's versed in comp law. And the third one is Social Security disability. If you have a Social Security disability claim, you contact them and there will be no charge whatsoever for that consult. So how do you reach them? Well, you phone them at 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Now, maybe you don't need some help on a legal issue, but you've got a relative or a sibling or an offspring in some other state that does. Well, this program is not unique to the Hartford County Bar. It is built on a model that comes from the American Bar Association, and there are similar programs in most parts of the country. So we've had a number of people that have called the local office and said, I'm nowhere near you folks, but can you refer me to a similar program where I live? And generally speaking, they can usually help. So I'm aware of referrals to California, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Texas, a few in the Midwest. And so they can help you in that fashion, and there's no fee for them referring you to a similar program. The numbers may change slightly in a different part of the country, but the general concept is exactly the same. So once again, give a call to the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. Believe me, you're going to get better help than you would if you select an attorney from some billboard you saw on the highway or from some internet ad that was placed by God knows whom. Okay, that's the story, and now let's get back to some of the programming that I promised you. Earlier on, we talked a little bit about people in court, especially in housing court, especially in family court, being upset with the conduct of a particular judge. They don't like the way she ruled. They didn't like the way he conducted himself. Sometimes you hear him muttering under their breath in the court, or saying, I would sue that so-and-so. Well, here's the story of somebody who did and exactly what happened. And this was not done in an amateurish fashion. So let me tell you what happened, okay? This is a lawsuit in the New Haven Judicial District, and there was a decision less than a month ago. It's called Myers versus Emmons. And this is a claim that Judge Emmons engaged in some misconduct that affected the plaintiff and his minor son. Okay, what they're claiming is that Judge Emmons had been involved in all kinds of custody disputes and questions of child neglect and other matters, and that she was the Department of Children and Families was heavily involved in investigating into allegations. The claim is that Judge Emmons pressured DCF to curtail their investigations prematurely, pressured them to close cases, pressured them to delay or forego proper efforts to protect the minor plaintiff. Okay? Pretty serious allegations. So what happened is that Judge Emmons, who's defended by the Attorney General's office, filed a motion to dismiss all the counts against her. And she said, here's the story. There's sovereign immunity, there's statutory immunity, and there's what's called absolute judicial immunity. So in the event any of you listening had an experience at court that made you angry with the judge, upset with how the matter came out, and you said, well, I'm going to sue that person, you better consider that you're going to have to deal with these defenses, okay? And the first defense that was mentioned was sovereign immunity. Now, judges are employees of the state of Connecticut. The state of Connecticut is the sovereign, and this is an old Anglo-American legal concept. You cannot sue the sovereign without its consent. So generally speaking, with a couple of exceptions, notably motor vehicle accidents, you generally have to go to the Commission on Claims, state your claim, prove it, and get consent in order to file a lawsuit in the Superior Court. So that's sovereign immunity, and that was one of the defenses that was encountered in this case. The second defense was statutory immunity, and it had to do with whether the actions that the judge engaged in were judicial or not judicial actions. The third one, though, is really the killer, and that's called absolute judicial immunity. Now, judges have immunity for a lot of very, very good reasons. They make decisions. Usually there's a winner and a loser. If every time there was a loser, somebody could sue the judge, it would be very, very inefficient, and it would probably make it difficult for people to volunteer to be judges. So in order to have absolute judicial immunity, the judge basically has to do two things. It's a barrier, and in order to overcome it, here's what you have to do. First, the judge is not immune from liability for non-judicial actions. Those are actions not taken in the judge's judicial capacity. If you are driving down the road and stop at a stoplight and somebody rear-ends you, that person turns out to be a judge, they have no judicial immunity, okay? Second, the judge is not immune for actions which, even though they are judicial in nature, were done in the complete absence of jurisdiction, okay? So the judge judge can't go and do things simply because they're a judge. They have to have a proper case before them. Anyway, in this case, the motion to dismiss was granted by the court and apparently on some very sound reasons. So we pass that along. That is the concept of judicial immunity and why it is that if you're ever thinking about suing a judge for his or her conduct on the bench, that you're probably going to have a very formidable obstacle to do that. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back with more of Law Talk, and we're going to be doing all of that right after this. Okay, welcome back to Law Talk. I'm attorney John Matulis, and we're right here until at WTIC until 1 o'clock today, taking your phone calls, and let's go to the phones right now. Hey, Ken, you're on Law Talk, and how can we help you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My daughter was in a car accident. The person that hit her took off before the police showed up, but we got a name. But the police can't contact him. He's not, you know, making himself available. The insurance company on our side can't get a hold of him. I guess what I'm looking at is it looks like we're going to be on the hook for $500 of the deductible. So I'm wondering, does it make sense to go after him in small claims court?
Yeah, I think that it does because you are going to have a loss. Ken, what for our listeners, what you're talking about is your own insurance company paying because you've got an absent defendant here. They've taken off. Your situation is better than most because it sounds like somebody was able to ID this person, and it sounds like you know who it is.
Yeah, he left a copy of his license.
Oh.
That's really him.
Yeah, assuming that's him. It's a criminal offense to leave the scene of an accident like that, and I assume that the police are still pursuing this. But your question is about small claims court, and I would say, by all means, there's no reason that you should do without $500, which is the deductible under your policy, because of the fact that this person decided to just take off and in the process commit a separate crime. Was there any kind of surveillance cameras or video that might have helped out with the accident where it occurred?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. I did talk to the police officer. He was very nice. He did a great job. But he kind of says, well, I can't find him, so I'm going to close the case, which doesn't seem right to me. But.
Yeah, let's ask about your daughter. Hopefully she wasn't injured badly.
Yep, she was fine.
Oh, good. Okay, well, that's the most important thing. So is it primarily a property damage claim then?
Yeah, actually, the first estimate came in at $5,000.
Well, just so that our other listeners know, your own insurance company has got to respond to that claim. And
right.
I'm going to branch out a little bit here to get into a topic called diminished value. And what that means is that the insurance company is going to offer you either the cost of repairing the vehicle, or if for some reason the value was less than the cost of repairing it, then they'd offer you the fair market value. And up until a few years ago, most of us, including in the legal profession, figured, well, that's a fair outcome. Trouble is, with the advent of things like Carfax and other sources of information that tell people whether a car has been involved in an accident, it turns out that once you're in an accident, even if that vehicle is fixed as good as it ever was, you still have a diminished value claim. I think it was a couple of shows ago, we did a diminished value claim here in Law Talk because somebody had a Tesla Model X, and there was a big fight over just the diminished value. Everybody agreed that the car was repaired to a standard that was as good as new, but the owner had an expert who said that the diminution in the value of the car, now that it had been in an accident, even though it was fixed, as good as new, was like $73,000.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm just sort of branching out here to have you aware of the fact that the insurance company is going to give a couple of estimates, and if you, as long as you have the choice of body shop to do the repair work, make sure that they will honor the estimate. Some insurance yep. companies are sort of sleazy on this. Others step right up and they take care of it. Some body shops will discover that there's internal damage that wasn't known when the estimate was first done. So if you have a body shop in mind, just make sure that they're comfortable with the carrier and with the estimate. And okay. Then you have this diminished value business, and I don't know very much about your car, but I felt it was a good idea to let you know that that is a part of your claim. And the insurance right. so, companies hate to hear this, but the right. law has become very, very clear on it. If you can demonstrate that the value is diminished, notwithstanding the fact the car has been repaired, you're entitled to that as an element of your damages.
Right. And could I put a little bit in there for, you know, time and whatever, or?
You can always put it in there. The court probably won't award it, though. But okay. it's small claims court. There's no appeal from there. And my advice to you would be give it a try, because the worst that can happen is that the small claims magistrate doesn't award it. And there's no appeal. If the insurance company conduct bothers that person, they may award you something for that.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a good approach, but by all means, you know, you've got your deductible, and then on the amount of the claim itself, just make sure that if the body shop finds any hidden damage when they start actually doing the work, that the insurance yep. company is going to step right up and deal with it. The good ones, generally, that's not a problem, but right. insurance companies are like people. You know, some okay. are good, some not so much.
What's the max you can do with small claims?
$5,000.
$5,000?
$5,000.
I'm sorry, what was that amount again?
Yes, $5,000.
Okay, I got you.
Okay.
All right, that's great. Answered my question.
Well, great. Thanks for calling, Ken. And don't hesitate to call us on a future show and let us know how it turns out, okay?
Yep, sure. Sounds
okay.
good. Thank you very
Excellent.
Much.
Take care and good luck with that. Bye now. Yep. All right. Very interesting conversation there. Just wanted to remind you that the diminished value aspect of these claims is real. It is accepted by the courts. Virtually all of the judges are now familiar with it, although that was not necessarily the case several years ago. And the cases are pursued to a greater extent than they used to be. So if you end up in an accident, the diminished value of the vehicle is generally a function of the fact that with Carfax and similar services now, once your car is in an accident, it generally pops up. And if you go to sell that vehicle, just about any used car salesperson is going to tell you, well, it's worth less as a result of being reported in an accident than it would have been if there was no such report. Even if it's been fixed as good or better than it was otherwise, there's still a diminution in value. So that is the story on that. And we've got... only a few minutes left. I see that there's a call coming, which we'll try to start if our producer, Tom, puts it on, and we'll finish that off air. But in the meantime, I was going to tell you about this Supreme Court decision, and this was last week also. This involves Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, all these other similar sites, okay? They are all private companies. They have all reserved the right to edit or to cancel people from the use of their sites for conduct that they consider inappropriate, okay? Well, there are some folks in politics and in government who don't like that. And previously, the state of Florida passed a law which prohibited the social media sites from doing that kind of restrictions. Well, Texas just passed a similar law like that, and it went to the local federal district court, which enjoined the law, said it was improper. Then the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, it's not improper. So it ended up at the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, this Texas law is no good. And what's funny about it is the lineup of some of the parties, some of the organizations advocating for free expression on the internet, they all wanted to block the Texas law. They said it's too hard to make it, to remove the offensive material that otherwise shows up. The bottom line is that the 11th Circuit in a ruling said, with respect to the Florida law, put simply, with minor exceptions, the government cannot tell a private person or entity what to say or how to say it. So that's the story there. And for those of you that watch what's going on with those social media websites, that you have it. Another Law Talk's coming to an end. I want to say thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Tom, our producer. He's the guy that you first hear when you call me. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and I'm the one who gets the opportunity to visit with you on these Saturday afternoons at noontime. So until next Saturday, see ya.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.